debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, it's the Tom Hartmann Podcast, brought to you by Cameron Hughes Wine. There's a little secret that most people don't know about the highest quality wineries in the United States and how they work. They'll say, you know, as they start their year, okay, we're going to bottle, say, 5,000 bottles of wine this year. And so they overproduce for that, produce enough for maybe 6,000 bottles of wine. But, you know, they've sold 5,000, they're ready to get 5,000 out. And so that's basically all they do under their own label. And then when they're done, they've got casks of wine left over that haven't been bottled. Cameron Hughes contracts with some of the very best vineyards in America to take that essentially surplus wine. I mean, you know, it's the exact same wine you would buy in a bottle for 50, 60, 100, one of the Cameron Hughes wines I had last week, the retail price, if you knew who the brand was over $150 a bottle. Cameron Hughes buys that in bulk, bottles it, puts just a simple number. Here it is, lot 506 or lot 622, simple number on it, and you get some of the most spectacular wines at huge discounts off what you would normally pay. Cameron Hughes has been doing this since 2001, seeking out high-end wine from around the world and selling it online direct to his customers. This is not just American wines, earning Cameron Hughes Wine the number one wine brand online. It's just extraordinary stuff. I recently sampled lot 609. This is a Cabernet Sauvignon. It was insane. It was so good. It was bold. It was rich. It had the black fruit and red licorice and crushed red rock, all these extraordinary tastes, juicy and ripe on the palate. You got to check this out. Go to chwine.com/Tom, T-H-O-M. C-H as in Cameron Hughes, that's his name, the guy who started the company and runs it. I've talked with him. He's a great guy, and he's doing amazing stuff. chwine.com/T-H-O-M. Or text the word wine, W-I-N-E, text the word wine to 511-511, and you'll get free shipping with your minimum three-bottle order. So text wine to 511-511, Cameron Hughes Wine. Exceptional value. Extraordinary wine. Now enjoy the podcast.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you live from Portland, Oregon, and Paul Ryan is going to be with us, not the Trump enabler in the House of Representatives, but the good Paul Ryan. He's with Common Cause, and we're going to be talking about Trump's totally legal tweet. Jamal Abdi is going to drop by. He's the vice president of the National Iranian American Council, NIAC, and we're going to be talking about the sanctions. We're also going to get into how neoliberals are trying to break Canadian health care. But to start out today, because I am going to talk about these other things. I'm not going to talk about the fact that convicted criminal Joe Arpaio says he would accept oral sex from Donald Trump. Yes, Sasha did it. But what I do want to talk about is, how do you save the planet from reality TV watchers and Trumpsters. And are you one of those people who voted for Donald Trump and now regrets it? And if so, I'd love to hear from you. Do you now regret voting for Trump because of his racism? You know, his tweets about LeBron, his most recent recurring theme throughout his, well, throughout his life, it seems, is that black people are stupid and stuff like that. I mean, this was the essence of trashing both LeBron James and Don Lemon for being dumb and black. Is it because he lied that he was going to bring jobs back? And we've actually seen over the first 18 months of his presidency an increase in the number of jobs leaving the United States. Is it because he lied that he was the only Republican on stage who was going to protect your Social Security and Medicare? And the budget that they passed, or the tax bill that they passed, actually cuts by hundreds of millions of dollars the administrative staff for Social Security and Medicare, thus increasing your wait times and frustration and difficulty. And we're going to get into that, by the way, in the program, too. That whole issue of neoliberalism as sabotage. Is it because he promised to tax the rich? He said, oh, my God, I'm going to pay more in taxes. I mean, you know, a member of my family, my neighbors, when we lived in the marina in Washington, D.C., voted for Donald Trump after earlier supporting Bernie Sanders. And they voted for Trump because they believed these things. They believed that he was going to bring jobs back. They believed that he was going to protect Social Security and Medicare. They believed he was going to tax the rich. They believed he was going to drain the swamp and get the lobbyists out of Washington, D.C. Instead, he's put them in his cabinet and in charge of agencies. They believed that he was going to have a humane immigration policy, and now he's ripping children from their mothers. They believed that he would be somebody who would respond to emergency crises, unlike George W. Bush when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. And over 1,000 people, the vast majority of them African-Americans, died. You know, people believed that he wouldn't do that to another place, and now he's done it to Puerto Rico. And a lot of people are just saying, I regret voting for him because the guy's nuts. Look at his tweets. You know, there's some news reports now that indicate we all know he watches at least a few hours of television a day. There's at least one news report out suggesting that he watches as much as 8 hours of television in a day. Jeremy Montanez was so regretful that he voted for Trump that he apologized to the entire country on CNN. He said, I want to apologize to the nation for my vote for him. This was on CNN's New Day program. He said it was the wrong thing to do. It was the biggest mistake I ever made. Montanez also called the president a racist, pointing to his lack of attention to Puerto Rico's devastation by Hurricane Maria as an example. But it's not just saving us from Trump. You know, how many of us got sucked in by this? Back when Louise and I started two different ad agencies and built them up and sold them off, and I used to teach marketing and advertising for the American Marketing Centers, and one of the things that you know when you're in the advertising business is that the main message of advertising is you are the most important person in the world. You need this. You deserve this. That's the message that is embedded in most advertising, but it's also embedded in programming. I've told you the story many times of a study that, I'm sorry, I don't have the study in front of me. This was in the 70s or 80s, and I heard this on NPR, and I've not been able to successfully find it, but I remember it very vividly. This was a group of scientists in Michigan, I believe it was at Michigan State University, or the U of M. And, you know, squirrels make nests for the winter. And they're a certain size, right? In the winter, in particular, you can see these nests in the trees. You know, they look kind of like giant bird's nests. They're typically made out of leaves. So they went around and they added 20% to the size of a couple of the nests. And sure enough, by the next year, all the squirrels were making nests that were 20% larger. We are mammals, just like squirrels. We are wired to catch what's going on with the Joneses and say, hey, I need to do that too. I should do that same thing. So now comes this study from the London School of Economics and Political Science. This is not just some little thing, you know, that some grad student did or, you know, some speculation. This is an actual scientific study done by the London School of Economics Department of Media and Communications, studying the responses of 487 British adults ages 18 to 49. It was masked as a memory and attention test. People didn't realize that they were being evaluated for their attitudes on whether poor people, injured people, disabled people, the working poor should have access to health care and things like that, should have access to basically a social safety net, long-term unemployment, or if, for that matter, the National Health Service in Great Britain should continue without further privatization. And here's what they, this is from the London School of Economics website itself, lse.ac.uk. Results showed a significant treatment effect of momentary exposure to materialistic media. This is 1 minute ads on both anti-welfare attitudes and support for anti-welfare policies. One intermittent minute of attention to common and typical materialistic media messages caused a significant increase in anti-welfare sentiments. And then you get to the TV viewing, and it's mind-boggling. They write, and again, I'm quoting from their report. Participants were also asked about the frequency of their viewing of 9 TV shows, such as The Apprentice, X Factor, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and Made in Chelsea. Results showed that those who also regularly watch shows such as The Apprentice and X Factor were more likely to hold, quote, stronger materialistic and anti-welfare attitudes than lighter consumers of these shows. Now, why would that be? They note, this is from the paper, cultural representations and endorsements of materialism, such as the promotion and glorification of fame, fortune, and conspicuous consumption, are particularly endemic in and promulgated by commercial media. They call this the materialistic media messages, MMMs, that are embedded in these programs like The Apprentice, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Made in Chelsea. And they go on to say that people who watch these programs, increased exposure to these programs, quote, increases body dissatisfaction in women and decreases well-being in children. Heavy consumption of MMMs is related to, or in other words, you know, reality TV, is related to increased levels of stress, life dissatisfaction, and anxiety. They go on to say, and I'm quoting from the study now, word for word, The Apprentice, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and X Factor are replete with MMMs that are engineered to absorb audiences into the glamorous world of wealth and celebrity, and thus have a strong potential to function as cultivators of materialistic values and attitudes. If there's more emphasis on materialism as a way to be happy, this makes us more inclined to be selfish and antisocial and therefore unsympathetic to less fortunate people. This study can contribute to explanations for why the UK's public support for welfare to aid the impoverished and unemployed has been decreasing during a time of rapidly growing wealth disparities, living costs, and rates of precarious underemployment. In other words, as things are getting worse, you would think that people would say, hey, you know, we're all getting in deeper and deeper trouble here economically and socially. We should be looking out for each other. We should be helping each other out. And instead, what's happening is things are getting worse. People are saying, screw the working poor. Screw the working people, for that matter. We all want to be like Donald Trump and the Kardashians. I would add the question to this. Is the Trump presidency, where Trump has turned even the chairs in the press room gold, is the Trump presidency influencing average Americans who watch Fox so-called news and follow the Trump presidency?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, were you influenced and are you regretful that you voted for Trump? I've been using the Muse EEG neurofeedback headband. I'm not sure that's exactly what they call it, but the website is choosemuse.com. It's a little headband you put on, just sets over your ears, sort of like a pair of glasses, only it goes across the forehead, and it actually reads your brain waves, your EEG, and feeds it back to you through a free app on your smartphone into your earphones, into your ears, as the sounds of weather. And as your brain gets more agitated, the weather gets louder, and as your brain gets calmer and more peaceful and more meditative, the weather gets softer and the waves get softer, and you start hearing little birds when you're having really cool brainwave activity that's associated with the way that good meditators do it. It's a meditation instruction tool, and meditation is such an incredible thing. It you know, helps concentration, focus, lowers blood pressure. I've been using this for about 4 or 5 months now, and I have noticed in my daily writing, because I've got a 10-book contract right now and I'm writing so much every single day. I used to sit down to write and say, okay, I'm going to write for an hour. And half of that hour was spent with distractions. I'd think of this and think of that. And, oh, I need to check my email. Oh, I got to do that. And I would constantly distract myself and then eventually come back to it. Since I've started using the Muse, now when these distractions pop up, just like they do in my meditation, I've learned how to, just like in my meditation, say, oh, that's a distraction. I'll let go of that. I'll come back to that later. I'm going to get back to writing. And now, instead of getting 30 minutes worth of work done in an hour of sitting and writing, I'm getting 50 or 60 minutes of work done in an hour of sitting and writing. It's really extraordinary. That you can learn all about it at ChooseMuse, M-U-S-E, ChooseMuse.com. And if you order using the code TOM, T-H-O-M, you get $30 off. So check it out. It's great. ChooseMuse.com. It's the Tom Harmon Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Come on, give me a break. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Yeah, I did that study in Britain you talked about, where people who watch materialistic things started to get very selfish. You know, there's a thing called a tendency in humans called demandingness, where they start to think they need things they simply want, demand what they simply desire. And even modern life makes people demanding, because as you get things all the time, very easily come to you, then you start to think you need them more. It's kind of like what happens to a kid. We spoil kids, but we get things to them too much, too often, and then they overreact emotionally to not getting those things. And I think that's what that explains why you see that the results you were talking about earlier in that British study.
Yeah, and it raises the question. I mean, egalitarianism is wired into us. Self-sacrifice is wired into us, but so is survival. And so these are two very, very powerful instincts that are literally part of our DNA. And it would be fascinating. Obviously, it's not the kind of study that you could do. It would violate every rule of ethical science out there. But it would be fascinating to know if you and I, Ray, were on the bottom of the ocean and we knew that it was going to take us 20 minutes to get to the surface without the bends, and we had 5 minutes worth of air. Or let's say 10 minutes worth of air, which would be 20 minutes if one of us was dead, which one of us would say, okay, I'm going to take the air away from the other, or which one of us would say, you know, you can have my air. I'll just die right here so that you can live. And I wonder to what extent that might have to do with the relationship that we had. I mean, if you were my brother, or if you were my son, or if you were my father, would I be more inclined to sacrifice myself than if you were my neighbor?
Or if you were somebody who I perceived as being the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to see, what I'm trying to say is, this is exactly what Trump and Republicans and the oligarchs who are people like Kochs and stuff, this is what they're encouraging people to do. They're encouraging to look at the world this way, that, you know, somebody is taking something away from you that you need.
Right.
And that's what they're triggering all these, you know, this anti-immigrants, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's all zero-sum thinking. You know, there's only a limited amount of stuff to go around, and we need to grab all we can. And if those people come from Mexico, they want some of our stuff, you know.
You really have to fight your natural tendency to plug into that survival instinct.
Yeah.
You know, it really takes a lot to fight that.
And most people can't do that, particularly in the face of all this media. Ray, thanks for the call. That's a very thought-provoking call. Brilliant observation. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard, did you vote for Trump, or did you just know people who did?
I know a lot of people who did. I think it is a little missing the point in regards to the people who voted for Trump, trying to give them a pass for actually regretting the decision. The reason being is because we knew about his racism. We knew about his con man act. We've known about him going about and defrauding the veterans organizations. None of this stuff is actually secret information. This is publicly accessible.
I agree, Richard, but those things that you're talking about, you say we know these things, we who are news junkies, we who are political junkies, we who pay careful attention to these things, the vast majority of Americans don't fit in that category. The vast majority of Americans are just working their butts off, trying to get by, hanging out with their friends, spending time with their kids. They have a life. Not to say that news junkies don't have a life, but the focus of their life is not the news or the Trump administration, where for many of us it is. You know, it's like, you know, we're really concerned about the future of our democracy. And so I'm still willing to cut those people some slack.
The reason as to why I'm not really willing to give them that concession is in the same vein that I don't like to give George Bush that concession that he wasn't all that bright when it came to his policies and procedures. And I'm talking about Junior.
Yeah.
We try to give him a pass for being, oh, well, he wasn't that bright and he was the butt of many comedians' jokes during his presidency. Great. But the simple fact of the matter was his actions did have very real consequences.
And continue to.
It ended up in ruining, if not ending, quite a number of people's lives. And the thing that's really annoying about it is, as far as Americans are concerned, we didn't really care too much about it because we weren't on the receiving end of it.
Yeah.
And I think that also plays into the whole Trump support regret, the whole buyer's remorse regarding his Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
in the fact that they didn't really care too much about it, about Trump being racist, about Trump being extremely nationalistic, about Trump actually advocating or encouraging more extreme fascist elements to act out because he'd go about in supporting their legal fees. They didn't, these supporters that experienced buyer's remorse, didn't start experiencing that buyer's remorse until those policies started affecting them personally, which is kind of the same trait that you have with a lot of more right-wing, more conservative-minded individuals. Empathy really isn't one of their strong suits. So it's something that they don't actually start regretting until they become personally affected by it.
Yeah, it may be. And your talk about Bush and his toxicity, I mean, he basically broke our military, too. One of my daughters sent me an article in the Military Times about how the, all these generals are now calling to bring back the draft because the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq just destroyed us. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. The neoliberal assault on Canadian Medicare. I wanted to get into this for a minute. Lambert Strether is writing over at NakedCapitalism.com, which sounds a little risque, but it's not. It's actually a really great progressive website for economists, for progressive economists and progressive economics. And there is a playbook that neoliberals use, and both in the Republican and Democratic Party, and particularly neoliberals in the media, there is an actual playbook that they use to take us from publicly funded programs to privatized programs, whether it's the electric grid, you saw this played out with Enron in California, whether it is the water system, whether it's the septic systems, whether it's public schools, whether it's public health care, whether it's the Veterans Administration, whether it's the Social Security Administration, whether it's the post office. You see all these things that we all collectively pay for, that we all collectively want to be produced for the benefit of all Americans at the lowest possible cost. And without the profit motive, because these are things that affect all of our lives. These are things that directly have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as opposed to just getting stuff. I don't want the government making my jeans. I don't want them making my shoes. I don't want them making my car. You know, I lived in Germany. I remember the Ladas made in Russia and the Trebis made in East Germany. They were terrible cars. Right, these little three-cylinder cars in East Germany, going down the street to just, you know, blowing smoke out the back because they were two-cycle engines. I don't want the government doing any of that stuff. There is an entirely and large and appropriate place for private industry in the United States. But I don't want the profit motive sitting between me and the water coming out of my tap, sitting between me and the electricity coming into my house, sitting between me and the septic system that goes out of my house, sitting between me and my health care, sitting between me and my internet connection, sitting between me and my schools, and sitting between me and my post office. Those are all things that we have, for a long time in America, had a broad consensus should be part of the commons, the stuff that we all own and we all use, the stuff that is essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the neoliberalism playbook is very, very specific. The classic example that we're watching right now of a neoliberal train wreck happening right now as I speak is with Social Security and Medicare. And it happened last year when the Republicans passed this tax bill and this piece of a budget bill that cut funding for the Social Security Administration and Medicare, not for your benefits. They didn't cut your benefits yet, but they cut the staff of Social Security and Medicare. And the reason they did that was so that the service that you get when you call Social Security and Medicare sucks, right? So step one in the neoliberal playbook is defund the program, reduce the funding for the program, break the program, wreck the program, demoralize the people who are administering the program, cut resources to the people who are administering the program, force them into a frenzy, you know, just, oh my God, I've got so much work to do. I can't even take your phone call right now. I'm sorry. That kind of thing, right? Number one, defund or sabotage the program. We saw this with the post office in 2005. The Congress passed the Postal Reform Act, and literally the night before this was passed, in the night, a Republican slipped into that bill, and we still don't know who it was, slipped into that bill this provision that said that the post office had to start setting aside $5 billion a year, starting in 2005, set aside $5 billion a year for 10 years to pay for the health insurance costs of postal workers who retire 75 years after 2005. In other words, in 2080. There's no reason for this. It's never been done before with any government agency. It's never been done in private industry. There's absolutely no reason for it. The post office is now sitting on $50 billion in a savings account that they can't spend until 2080. Now, why did they do this? To dramatically damage the service of the post office. The post office in 2005, when they passed this law, was on the verge of electrifying their entire fleet. But they had to break it. They had to break the post office first. And then they could call for step two. They could say, there's a crisis. Oh, my God, there's a crisis. Social Security's in a crisis. Look at the long wait times and they're doing this, by the way, with the Canadian healthcare system right this minute. Oh, my God, look at these long wait times in Canada. Well, actually, they're not. But, you know, so declare the crisis. Number three, call for privatization. Oh, we've got to have privatization. This is what they did with the Veterans Administration. They said, veterans, the VA is not taking care of our veterans in a timely fashion. This is after years of cutting funding for the Veterans Administration. The VA is not keeping up with the demands of the Veterans Administration as a result of the two wars that George Bush lied us into, Bush and Cheney. They said, oh, my God, there's a crisis. The Veterans Administration, we're not going to give them enough money to serve people. Then they said, oh, my God, there's a crisis. People aren't being served. Then they said, let's privatize part of the functions. And President Obama actually went along with this. Right? I mean, you know, we gave people these vouchers so that they could go to private practitioners. And then number four, profit. Ka-ching! We're making money off what should be a public function. Wow, ShareBlue Media has an amazing story by Eric Bollard. And, you know, Eric's a pretty solid guy. He's been writing for Media Matters for years and years. In fact, I think he might be even an executive at Media Matters or one of the people who's involved with the company. He writes, grifters are going to grift and then they go to work for Trump. A stunning new expose from Forbes magazine reveals that Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who, by the way, when he became Commerce Secretary, we were all told he's worth multiple billions of dollars, as much as $5 billion. Turns out he's worth $800 million. He lied about how rich he was. Anyhow, that Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross has been allegedly siphoning off money from his colleagues for years, lots and lots of money. And then they quote, this is a quote from Forbes, quote, and Forbes magazine, I mean, they sourced this. This is solid stuff. Those who've done business with Ross generally tell a consistent story of a man obsessed with money and untethered to facts. If even half of the accusations are legitimate, the current United States Secretary of Commerce could rank among the biggest grifters in American history. And over several months in speaking with 21 people who know Ross, Forbes uncovered a pattern. Many of those who worked with him claim that Ross wrongly siphoned or outright stole a few million here and a few million there, huge amounts for most, but not necessarily for the Commerce Secretary. But all these allegations, which sparked lawsuits, reimbursements, and an SEC fine, come to more than $120 million. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Vicki in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Vicki, what's on your mind today?
Well, I think that there is a silent demographic group of people who are already on board with a Democratic platform just because of who they are. Mm-hmm. I'd represent them today by letting you know that I only have a landline. I can't afford a cell phone. I don't have cable. So I watch ABC, CBS, NBC, period.
Right.
And I live on Social Security after 30 years as an RN. And the only reason why I own my home is because I worked enough overtime to double my income to buy one. Yet I just had to do a reverse mortgage to keep my home. And my point is, you described the answer in several of your books. The people on the progressive left need to get together, get on mainstream media, like an ABC station that's available to people without cable, just to counter all the fake news. So when people go to vote, they're voting from their experience and the truth that's presented in these major media stations. Had I not been a person that listened to Democracy Now and your station for years, I wouldn't not have any information, because you don't get anything in, you know, currently on NBC, CBS, ABC, and PBS, very little to counter any of this. So there's a whole group of people that aren't being indoctrinated in fake media, but they are getting it kind of a no counter arguments against this stuff on the few media stations that are available. So what we need to do is make sure that we own one of those major stations, that people that don't have much money or resources can actually get the information they need.
I understand and absolutely agree with your sentiment, Vicki, but wow. I mean, it's like if you watch the Sunday shows, or for that matter, if you watch anything, and you said you don't have cable, so you're not watching it, but if you were to tune into CNN or MSNBC and you see one of these, quote, political discussions, or you see any of the programs throughout the day, with a very rare exception in the evening primetime block, you will not see actual progressives on television, even as guests, much less as hosts. And even the progressive hosts are very narrowly circumscribed in the topics they can talk about. They can't talk about corporate mergers. They can't talk about net neutrality, or at least not on any kind of a regular basis. They can't talk about the corporate dominance. They can't talk about neoliberalism. These giant corporations that own our media don't want to hear that. You know, my own experience, I had a conversation a number of years ago, 5, 6 years ago, maybe longer than that. No, it had to be about eight or nine years ago, with a senior executive at one of the networks that you mentioned, about being a host for them. And, you know, basically what came out was that I was too far left, whatever the hell that means. I mean, I support Medicare for all. I support strengthening Social Security. I'm not as far left as Franklin Roosevelt was. Well, actually, I am. But America is right there, too. You know, similarly, when I was supporting Bernie during the primary, and of course, I supported Hillary after she won the primary, right up to the day of the election, worked really hard to support her. But when I was supporting Bernie, we even had a threat from one of our radio stations saying, you continue supporting Bernie, we're going to take you off the air. We basically said, you really don't want to do that. You know, you're shooting yourself in the foot. But the media of the United States, particularly the media that's owned by giant corporations and some of these very, very conservative, very right-wing corporations, do not want a progressive message out there, because the so-called moderate message in the Democratic Party anyway, but I would say also in the Republican Party, the so-called moderate message is really a corporatist message. It's really, you know, yeah, I'm a moderate politician. That means I take money from big corporations, I take money from billionaires, and occasionally I do something that's sort of progressive, but certainly not always. That doesn't seem moderate to me. That seems sellout to me, but that's what the media wants.
And that's my point. And that's my point. And that's why I say, long, you've written in your books a long time ago, these group of right-wingers got together and decided they wanted to control mass media, and they were able to do it. I'm not saying we can do that before this next election. I'm just saying that's what must be done.
Yeah, I agree. And this is why, you know, I wrote an op-ed a month or so ago saying to Tom Steyer, you know, the billionaire who's supporting the movetoimpeach.com website, you know, Tom, if you really want to have an impact on the American elections going forward, and not just this one, but for decades, instead of pouring millions of dollars into trying to impeach Donald Trump, that'll happen when it becomes obvious to every American that it should happen. Instead, buy one of the big radio networks. Clear Channel was for sale at the time that I wrote that op-ed. And I was, you know, I said, buy Clear Channel. Of course, that didn't happen. Vicki, thank you for your call. It's a very poignant and trenchant point that you're making, and thank you very much.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
And let's check in with Paul S. Ryan, the good Paul Ryan. He's the vice president for policy and litigation at Common Cause, commoncause.org. You can tweet him at the Paul S. Ryan. And Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you with us always. So Donald Trump says that his meeting in Trump Tower was perfectly legal. Take this apart for us, please, or explain this to us.
Well, I'll just put it in simplest terms. The president's wrong, and the meeting in Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and others did seemingly violate at least one federal campaign finance law, possibly multiple campaign finance laws. So which law was violated? The law that prohibits soliciting a contribution from a foreign national.
Or a thing of value.
Yeah, I mean, that's the allegation that Common Cause made in a complaint that we've sent to the Department of Justice on July 10th, 2017, so over a year ago. And I think you were just about to get into this. The term contribution in the law is defined to mean anything of value given for the purpose of influencing an election. Here we know that going into that meeting, Trump Jr., Donald Trump Jr., was told that he was going to be given information that would be damaging to Hillary Clinton, opposition research information. And this type of information, Oppo research, is regularly bought and sold by political players at every level of politics. It is definitely something of value, and Donald Trump Jr. and the campaign asked for that free Oppo research on Clinton in this Trump Tower meeting.
There are reports that it was actually in the public domain. It was on Twitter, and there were some news stories in relatively obscure publications, but this was before any of this stuff came out, that the Russians had Hillary's emails, that they were going to leak this stuff, that, you know, get ready, you know, et cetera. What's the timeline here? What does this say about conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to commit the crime of violating the campaign laws by taking a thing of value from a foreign actor, that sort of thing? What do we know about what has happened?
Well, we don't know whether or not Team Trump did in fact receive something of value from the Russians during that Trump Tower meeting or as a result of that meeting. If Team Trump did, and there's pretty good reason to at least believe they may have and to conduct a thorough investigation, then that opens the door to several other violations of federal law, including other provisions of the Federal Election Campaign Act, as well as provisions of the criminal code. So what are those additional violations? I already mentioned violation number one that looks like it occurred regardless of whether they got anything of value. That's the ban on soliciting a contribution from a foreign national. If they, in fact, received something of value, hacked emails that were stolen from the Clinton campaign or the DNC or any other valuable campaign material, we're looking at additional violations of receiving an illegal foreign national contribution. That's a violation of the campaign finance laws. And failing to report a receipt of an in-kind contribution, another violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act. And it's that failure to report that opens the door to other prosecution for other crimes, including, for example, the one you just mentioned, conspiracy to defraud. Now, the Department of Justice has historically relied on that crime, conspiracy to defraud, to include instances in which a candidate or other political player has tried to mislead the Federal Election Commission or obstruct the FEC's enforcement of laws like the ban on foreign national contributions. So filing an incomplete disclosure report with the FEC, that is subject to a charge of conspiracy to defraud. There are a couple other criminal statutes that prohibit lying to the federal government. And we also have attempted conspiracy counts that could be thrown on top of all of these. So, you know, by my math, that gets us to, if they in fact received something of value from the Russians to influence the campaign, at least six different counts of federal law violations.
Wow. And there was an event on July 7 and an event on July 9. And I don't remember which one was the meeting in Trump Tower and which was Trump telling an audience that any day now he was going to be releasing, that in a week or two he was going to hold a press conference and release dirt on Hillary. But he never held that press conference. He never did that. But the stuff came out from Guccifer and, you know, via WikiLeaks and all that. So what if they had this meeting and the Russians said, OK, we've got this information for you, say somebody who actually had some understanding of the election laws. I don't know if Paul Manafort qualified. Is that I doubt Jared Kushner or Don Jr., but maybe said, well, that's cool, but don't give that information to us because that's a clear violation of federal law. Instead, just release it, you know, via WikiLeaks or out to the press, because that's what happened. Would that minimize their liability?
I don't think so. It makes the case a little bit more complicated, but the scenario you're setting up would be the Trump campaign suggesting to the Russians that they disseminate this information independently, kind of,
or vice versa. I mean, it's possible that the Russians said to the Trump campaign, you know, we know campaign finance law and you don't want to get yourself in trouble here. Let us do this.
So the important point here legally is that if there's actual coordination, if there's conversations between a candidate and an outside group, Russians or an outside political spender, about how the outsider will release info or do something helpful to the candidate, that means that's no longer independent. That is treated under the law as if they'd given the something of value, directly to the campaign. This coordination turns independent political activity into an in-kind contribution to the campaign, subject to the same all about the campaign finance laws the campaign's general counsel, Don McGahn. He was the former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, and today he is White House counsel. I cannot imagine that he would not be involved in these high-level decisions around campaign activity, nor can I imagine that he did not brief the high-level campaign staff, at the very least, about the rough requirements of federal campaign finance law. And not taking contributions from foreign nationals, that's campaign finance law 101.
So this might have been Don McGahn's bright idea to pass along. It also raises another interesting question, which is Donald Trump's tweet blew my mind. I remember when Michael Flynn, when they were closing it, Michael Flynn had hired his son, or his son was involved in his consulting company, and his consulting company was all tied up in this whole Russia-Trump thing. And when Mueller started going after Flynn's son, Mike Jr., Michael Flynn said, hey, don't take out my son. If you stop trying to prosecute my son, I will turn state's evidence. I'll give myself over to you. You send me to jail instead of my kid. Donald Trump, on the other hand, says, yeah, Don Jr. was there. The meeting was about getting this information. And by the way, I knew nothing about it, which says something, I think, about his personality and his ethics and how much he loves his kids. But beyond that, if we were to assume for a moment that Donald Trump actually told the truth in that tweet, that he actually did know nothing about it, what does this mean for Don Jr. and what does this mean for Don Sr.?
Well, it means that if Don Sr. knew nothing about this, then he would not be personally liable for the types of crimes that I've been discussing earlier in our conversation. But the campaign committee is a legal entity. It was represented at this meeting by Don Jr., Kushner, Manafort. They were campaign officials. So the campaign committee itself could quite possibly be found to have violated federal law. And the individuals themselves, as agents of the campaign committee, likewise could be found to violate these federal laws. I want to circle back 1 minute to Don McGahn because
sure.
You mentioned maybe this was his idea. You know, Don McGahn knows federal campaign finance law inside and out. I don't want to imply that I believe that any of this was his idea. I think that he would probably have given the correct legal advice to his clients, which is don't do any of this. Now,
right.
I think it's very possible that Team Trump ignored that advice, but Don McGahn and I have agreed on almost nothing throughout our careers on campaign finance law and issues, but he knows the law, and I think he would have counseled his clients correctly.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Paul Ryan, the good Paul Ryan, the Vice President of Policy and Litigation at Common Cause, commoncause.org. You can tweet him at @ThePaulSRyan. Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. Fascinating conversation. A lot of stuff to chew on there. A lot to think about. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman with you. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, Luke Vargas, out of New York. You can follow him on Twitter @TheCourier. Luke, I see that the world has surpassed a terawatt. Is that a trillion watts in renewable energy generation? Is this a big milestone?
Yeah, 1,000 gigawatts. And I apologize in advance if my audio isn't perfect. We haven't done video in a while, and you used to not be able to do the video over the Skype. So
yeah, no, it sounds good, actually.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, so this is a big milestone. 1 terawatt equals the amount of power generated in the United States altogether. So this is a huge milestone. It's also equal to the amount of coal power generation in China. And we are, we're hitting a milestone. This is something that was predicted by Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which is a think tank focusing on renewable energies. They said we would hit this precisely when we did. What we've actually done is sort of beat expectations, because their calculations about 5 years ago about how uptake of renewable energy was going to occur did not think that photovoltaic cells, these solar cells, would be as cheap as they are. And in fact, prices have come down faster than anyone expected, which is a great thing. Of course, you know, we now have President Trump putting tariffs on imported photovoltaic cells, which is going to probably slow down some possible uptick that could have occurred in adoption of solar energy in the United States. But even still, we're doing well. We're hitting these targets. One thing that's really cool here is that basically all economists I've spoken to said 5 to 10 years from now, solar and wind are going to be absolutely compatible, gigawatt for gigawatt. These are, already seeing in certain markets competitive pricing for these renewable technologies, that the prices should be basically even everywhere within 5 to 10 years. And it took us 40 years and $2.3 trillion to get to this first terawatt of renewable energy. The next terawatt is going to cost half as much, and we're going to install it within the next 5 years. So this technology is really accelerating. One problem, as I mentioned, are these Trump tariffs on imported PV cells and uncertainty, which I think everyone can understand about really if the Trump administration has an all-of-government approach that takes renewable energy seriously. But on the upside, one surprising positive comment coming from the Union of Concerned Scientists when I spoke to them this morning is that the Trump administration has okayed the development of a number of offshore wind farms on various sort of the continental shelf.
Right. So, and in our remaining 40 seconds here, I wanted to get into Saudi Arabia. This is a big deal in my mind. Canada has called out Saudi Arabia's human rights records. Saudi Arabia is trashing Canada for that. Is the United States going to defend Canada, or are we going to defend Saudi Arabia?
Well, by our silence on human rights, we will probably defend by proxy the Saudis, though I don't think we're going to wade into this one, given the fact that the Saudis have called off all business dealings with Canadians. They've revoked 18,000 scholarships for students to study abroad in Canada. The ambassadors have been recalled. I think the 10-second conclusion here is that we might see Mohammed bin Salman pursuing reform to try and increase business in the country, but he's not going to be more tolerant of any dissent against that country's human rights policy. So that's actually going to make his broader economic ambitions, I think, difficult in the years to come.
Yeah, and you look at what he's doing in Yemen, for example, it seems like he's just really committed to autocracy. I think a lot of people were hoping he'd be in favor of a little bit of democracy, but apparently not. Luke, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. You know, in the world of work, one of the most important things is one of the things that people probably think the least about until they have to sit in it, which is their chair. And the X chair is absolutely extraordinary. This is the new high-tech. In fact, they've got a brand new version. It's called the X3, the newest version of the X chair. It is comfortable. It is high-tech. And yes, I'll say it, it is sexy. This chair is extraordinary. And it will dramatically, consequentially improve your concentration and productivity because it's going to help your posture. And, you know, if you're not in pain and your blood is working, you know, flowing well, your brain is going to work well. The new X3 is quite simply the most modern, ergonomic, high-tech, comfortable office chair in the world, period. The X3's unique ATR fabric makes it feel like you're literally floating on air. And its patented split-back lumbar technology provides a cradling, customized feel that has to be experienced to believe. You need to see and feel the X3 for yourself. Go to xchairtom.com. That's xchairtom.com now to check out the X3's perfect blend of design and ergonomics. A lot of people, you know, checking these out and going for these chairs. Supplies are limited, so don't wait. Order at xchairtom.com. And if you do it now, you get $100 off. That's xchairtom.com. Or you can call them at 1-844-4-X-CHAIR. This chair comes with a 30-day, no-questions-asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. That's how good it is. Go to xchairtom.com. Right now, use the code TOM, T-H-O-M, to get a free footrest. xchairtom.com. Now back to the podcast. On the line with us is our old friend Jamal Abdi with the National Iranian American Council, NIAC, N-I-A-C.org is the website. And Jamal, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Great. Great to have you with us. The big news, I think, tell me if it is or not, the European Union, this is from the Hill. The European Union, the EU, is warning businesses, European businesses specifically, that cut ties with Iran over new U.S. sanctions, that those firms could face EU sanctions. This is a quote from Nathalie Tosi, an aide to the EU's foreign policy head, that she told BBC Radio 4 yesterday. If EU companies abide by U.S. secondary sanctions, they will in turn be sanctioned by the EU. We're doing this in order to signal diplomatically to the Iranians that Europeans are serious about the Iran nuclear agreement. And the EU said on Monday that it would forbid European entities from complying with the sanctions. What's going on here?
The EU is fighting back. They announced that they would take this step, these blocking sanctions. They've done these in the past. It really, you know, it's a question now of how strictly will the EU actually enforce this? Will they actually have some bite to their bark and seriously, you know, go after their own companies who comply with the sanctions. Mm-hmm. I think that's up in the air, and there is more that the EU would need to do in order to not just have the costs for companies doing business with Iran, but also creating some banking channels, exploring ways that oil exports could continue through some sort of trading or bartering mechanism. So this is really, you know, I think this is a symbolic step. I think the EU has showed that it is very serious about protecting this deal. But the actual practical implications that remain to be seen. We've already seen European companies leaving.
Yeah, Daimler left. If it's mostly big German companies that are leaving, and Germany basically has the muscle to change EU policy, is that the source of your skepticism? Or a source?
That is a source. I think that large German companies probably will test this proposition. Mm. Now, I don't know that for sure, but it's a matter of, does the political will exist for the EU to actually carry out these measures?
So,
and really,
go ahead.
It's a game of chicken now between sort of Donald Trump and the EU.
So Standard Chartered Bank, which is a UK chartered bank, but they have U.S. branches and U.S. You know, they do business in the United States. In fact, they're one of their biggest branches is at 1095 Avenue of the Americas in New York. They are licensed to operate in Iran. And for among international banks, only about 25% of them are actually licensed to operate in Iran. So should Standard Chartered Bank in New York City be closed? I mean, is there any discussion of this? And then I want to get into where all this is going. I mean, if we're leading ourselves toward war with Iran.
Well, on your first question, that is what I would expect. The Trump administration posing to the rest of the world and these banks and companies, you either do business with Iran or you can do business with us. You can't do both. And so all the indications are that this administration is going to go after everybody as strictly as they can. So for now, I think they're following up on those threats. We've seen them back down a little bit on the oil sanctions. But we'll see how much of this is bluster and how willing they are to actually go after these companies.
Yeah, I just find it breathtaking. The Trump administration thinks that we can say to Britain or China or Chile or even Zambia, you know, if you do business with Iran, you can't do business with us. It just blows my mind. Is this a standard in past sanctions? I mean, is this the normal way that sanctions are done?
The sanctions on Iran are really the some of the broadest sanctions ever created. So these sanctions, you know, these are sanctions that came into force under the Obama administration, largely driven by Congress. But as far as the Obama administration was concerned, their role was to make sure that the rest of the world was actually bought into these sanctions.
Right.
And so they actually held off Congress for a long time. Well, not a long time, but they held Congress off so they could actually go to the UN, get approval for this, get the rest of the world to actually buy in. So it was much different. I don't think we've ever seen something quite like this where it's the United States versus the rest of the world in terms of enforcing its sanctions.
That's bizarre. So if we continue with this, and particularly in November, if we start blocking oil exports out of Iran, I understand already, and please fact check me on this, that the value of the Iranian currency has dropped by at least 70%, which means that everybody in Iran, at least on an international basis, is, you know, two-thirds less wealthy or three-quarters less wealthy than they used to be, than they were just a year ago, which is pretty shocking. I mean, that's got to have a huge impact on Iran. And I saw a thing in the Financial Times this morning that there were protests in the streets in Iran, in Tehran, yesterday. Could this, if the pressure is great enough on the Iranian government, might it provoke them to, rather than saying, oh, yeah, we'll come on bended knee to you guys and do exactly what you want, to instead say, we're going to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, and through which a very large percentage of the internationally traded oil in the world passes, and not just to the United States, by the way. And if they do that, might that be the thing that would lead us to World War III?
It's hard to envision anything other than an escalatory cycle right now. Donald Trump's offers of he's willing to negotiate with Iran without preconditions, which were then walked back by Mike Pompeo, who offered a bunch of preconditions. I think that in Iran, they are looking at those things, and politically, it's a non-starter, but there are a lot of question marks about, you know, who is running the policy in Washington? Is Trump serious? But this, you know, this whole approach is just, it's something that the Iranian, you know, government and in general, they're just allergic to, you know, this idea that they're going to be sort of forced to the table at the barrel of a gun. And so, yeah, this threat of closing the Strait of Hormuz, you know, it's not even the action of doing it. Even the threat is a form of leverage that that Iran has.
Has the Iranian government already issued that threat, or is that implicit?
They've suggested it. They maybe have not directly threatened that it's, you know, imminent. But if Iranian oil is taken off the market, it's likely going to mean that Saudi Arabia and others have to fill that gap, and they go into their excess capacity. So if they are running, you know, near their full capacity, and Iran actually takes some steps to, you know, suggest that it's going to do some things in the Strait of Hormuz, that could really, you know, do some bad things to the oil market, cause some real jitters, really spike the prices. And this could all happen, you know, ahead of the U.S. midterms. So I think, you know, I think Iran is looking at, you know, what kind of leverage do they actually have, because Donald Trump is going full bore with every piece of leverage that he has.
So
it's a
just
dangerous process.
Yeah, putting this in a historical context, back in the late 60s, early 70s, when we had, as I recall, two Arab oil embargoes or boycott embargoes, produced significant inflation and some serious problems in the United States, but it didn't lead to war. To what extent was Iran involved in any of that, or was that principally the Sunni countries?
Gosh, you're asking me historical questions.
I'm sorry. That, you know, if you're not sure, that's fine. I'm just curious. So what can go ahead?
I'm pretty sure Iran actually was helpful to the U.S.
Yeah.
During the embargo.
Yeah, I think that was before the Shah fell, so that would make sense.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and thank you for remembering that. I should have remembered it before I asked the question. So what can we do, what can Americans do to encourage our government not to take steps that could lead directly to, well, I'm saying this, that could lead directly to nuclear war? The scenario that I envision is the Iranians close the Straits of Hormuz, the Saudis, the Americans, the Israelis, somebody attacks Iran. Iran reaches out to Russia and says, help us out here. Russia attacks the countries that attacked Iran, and boom, we're in World War III, a thermonuclear, possibly World War III. A, do you think that that scenario is realistic? We've discussed this in the past. I'm curious your current thinking on this. And B, what can we do to prevent that?
Yeah, there are so many tripwires for an escalation towards war. I mean, exactly what you laid out, a war that brings in all of the parties who so far have been fighting proxy wars in the region, but never actually fighting directly against one another. So it's extremely dangerous. I think with sanctions, these are sort of, you know, these are the diplomatic version of a drone strike, where they almost are viewed as cost-free, that they can happen behind the scenes, and the American public is not really going to be aware of what we are doing. They inflict, you know, damage on populations, but largely out of the public eye. Sanctions, we're going to see humanitarian consequences. We are going to see medicine being denied to Iranians. We're going to see all kinds of aircraft that can't be repaired, and the cost of goods is going to go up. And so I think it's really important that we talk about these things, and that, you know, these are being done in our names as Americans.
Yeah.
It's collective punishment in our name.
It seems to me that if people are in the streets in Tehran or in Iran, that given the type of government Iran has right now, that's going to work to the detriment of reformers like Rouhani, and to the benefit of hardline right wingers who actually would not necessarily be all that worried about a war. They might see a war as a way of strengthening their power. And I'm concerned that Donald Trump might see the same thing.
Yeah, this is the comfort zone for hardliners in Iran's government. They love being in this spot. I think that this may be the death knell of the experiment of engaging the United States, at least for now. And for Donald Trump, I don't think he knows what he's gotten into. I don't think he's actually wrapped his head around this. He thinks that this is North Korea part two, and he's going to get some summit out of this.
Right.
He is surrounded by some of the biggest warmongers, and so this is really dangerous.
Yeah, John Bolton in particular. Jamal Abdi, the Vice President for Policy of the National Iranian American Council, NIAC, NIAC.org is the website. You can tweet him at J Abdi, ABDI. Jamal, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking with you. I always learn something, and I'm very concerned about this. Thank you. Welcome back, Donald, in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Social Security and Medicare, it really worries me. And I've called several times in the past about this. I've been on Social Security and Medicare for the last 3 years. Thank God for Medicare. I lost my house. I had two cancer surgeries. People don't know what they're going to lose until they lose it. Then they're going to find out. Right. What worries me about this whole thing is even if we take back the house, they had made such a mess of this of our budget. Could it be so where the Democrats might be forced to cut Social Security and Medicare just to keep it going? Would that ever happen?
Well, that's the plan. I mean, they even got President Obama to say that he would consider a chain CPI, which is a cut to Social Security. It backfired on him politically, and he backed away from it really quick. But the Republicans have been pushing him to do that, and some of the more, quote, moderate, end quote, Democrats. You know, who were taking money from the banks, who would make a fortune if Social Security was privatized. I'm more sanguine about the possibility that we're going to see Social Security and Medicare strengthened rather than cut. I think that the tide has turned.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I'm hoping you're right. You know, another thing that bothers me, the Social Security and Medicare, every time I hear people talking that they're going to get, even politicians, you don't see any retaliation from any of the senior citizens. Where are they screaming? They should be screaming about this. They should be on the phone. I hardly hear any of them talking about it. Are they all millionaires?
No, it's the problem is that the AARP, which just kind of gives milquetoast lip service to these kind of topics rather than being an activist organization, gets the vast majority of their money from UnitedHealthcare. And I mean, the vast majority, the AARP headquarters in D.C., I've been there, or I've walked by anyway, is mansion-esque. It's money pouring all over the place. And UnitedHealthcare is making so much money on Medicare. I mean, the Republicans drilled holes in Medicare, so it only covers 80% of your expenses. And so you have to buy insurance, supplemental insurance. And AARP sells the supplemental insurance from UnitedHealthcare. UnitedHealthcare has made so much money on this that their CEO, Stephen J. Hemsley, has made over $1 billion. He's taken over $1 billion out of that company. His predecessor, they called him Dollar Bill McGuire, took $1.5 billion out of UnitedHealthcare. Just one guy. And, you know, there's over 100 executives making over $1 million a year at UnitedHealthcare. So, you know, all these sweet ads and stuff. But you know, AARP knows which side their bread is buttered on. And they're not taking on the neoliberals. They're not taking on the big corporations. And that's the unfortunate part about it, Donald. Donald, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for the call. We need activist organizations for boomer seniors. And fortunately, there's not a good one out there, at least that I know of. Lindsay in Florence, Kentucky. Hey, Lindsay, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about wait times as far as Canadian healthcare versus here goes. Myself and my son both have some chronic conditions that require us to see specialists, and we live outside of the Cincinnati, Ohio area, so we have quite a few larger hospital systems. We have a large research university hospital here, and even with the plethora of providers that we have available to us, my son's neurologist wait time every year as an established patient, we schedule out 7 months.
Whoa.
In advance.
Yeah.
So when I hear these people say, oh, Canadian wait times, for a new patient, his pediatric neurologist schedules 11 months in advance.
Yeah.
And that's if you have a legitimate reason to go to her. If you are still in the diagnosis phase and you don't have a diagnosis yet, you can't get on her calendar.
Yeah,
So heaven forbid you have something legitimate wrong with you, you're still getting passed specialist to specialist through the system before you can actually see the person that will fix it for you. Close to a year as a new patient. So when I hear these wait time comments, I'm like, you know what? If it's less than 7 months, I'm calling it a win.
Yeah, there you go. We saw that Louise and I experienced the same thing, both when we moved to D.C. and then when we moved back to Portland. In both cases, we contacted local doctors and, you know, we'd like to be a new patient for you. And in D.C., the wait time was well over a year just for the first meeting with the doctor. And here in Portland,
right.
it was at least 5 or 6 months, as I recall. And, you know, what happens is the people who can afford to go to concierge docs, where you pay $500 a year or $1,000 or a couple thousand, in D.C.
Yeah.
it was $3,000 a year for a couple, they can afford to do it, and they get in right away, and everybody else is, you know, SOL. You got to go to the emergency room if you need your Synthroid refilled or something like that. Lindsay, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. You nailed it. Democracy is not a spectator sport. It takes all of us, and that includes you. There's a lot of great organizations out there you can participate with, a lot of ways you can make change happen. Get inside the political parties, Democratic or Republican. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.